This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Anatoly Karlin. We're going to be discussing transhumanism and also the topic of effective altruism. Anatoly, it's great having you back on the show.
As always.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Sam Kevorkian.
Hello.
So, both transhumanism and effective altruism, they're both these political scenes and intellectual scenes that you're involved with?
Involved in, with in what sense? I mean, when I was in the San Francisco Bay Area, I attended a lot of those meetings and conferences that people like Hank Pelissier and Scott Jackish, whom you've interviewed once, put up. So I haven't really done any serious, as in financial or academic work relating to that. So, I mean, I suppose it depends on how you define involvement.
So they're both, obviously, transhumanism as a scene is basically like the futurist movement. Is effective altruism, is that affiliated with futurism? Basically, to describe effective altruism, basically, it's about helping people in society in the most effective way possible. And there's a lot of talk. People like on the alt-right like to talk about pathological altruism. What got you into effective altruism? What are sort of the origins of the ideology, and is it kind of affiliated with that whole futurist transhumanist scene?
Well, okay. I'm not directly involved in effective altruism. I just think that it's a pretty interesting way of looking at charitable giving and things like that. The extent of my involvement is I once attended the conference in Berkeley last year, and that's about as far as my direct involvement with them goes. It makes a lot of sense because obviously when you provide help, you want to provide it in such a way that it helps the most people at the lowest cost. So it's really in some sense just a logical extension of utilitarianism. John Bentham, 19th century philosopher. So it's philosophical roots those, but it's pretty tightly interlinked with the futurist and transhuman scenes, that is correct. And I suppose there's a certain logic to that. First of all, it's sort of out of the way, but interesting idea, which Fox thinkers like futurists and transhumanists would tend to be attracted to, and it's also pretty quantitative, which also sinks in well with the culture there.
With the transhumanist scene, we've touched on this on previous podcasts. There's an interesting mix of people from a neo-reaction to people on the left and libertarians. Would you say effective altruism, is it fairly a kind of a centrist or rationalist movement? Are there liberals involved with effective altruism, or is there a significant interest from, say, a neo-reaction as well?
Well, it's very rationalist, yes. I mean, it's extremely bound up with rationalism. The foremost rationalist blogger, who's Scott Alexander Slade, Star Codex, he is directly affiliated with EA. And so is Eliza Jotkowski, who's a pretty central figure in the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, for instance, which is which are all those outfits which are involved in solving the control problem for future superintelligences. I mean, I've even heard some mischievous theories that Eliza Jotkowski got into EA because that was the most effective way of attracting money for machine intelligence safety research.
You wrote an article on the Owns Review about effective altruism. I guess the best example you gave was in regards to the migrant crisis and just the humanitarian arguments that the left makes for immigration. your argument basically is a pretty basic argument that it's much cheaper to give people, to fund people in their own country. I mean, one example you give is for the same amount of money it costs to house a migrant in Europe, you could pretty much afford a very comfortable middle class or even a luxurious lifestyle in a lot of poor countries.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the article in question is called Immigration and Effects of Altruism. It's from September 2015 at my blog on the UNSLI View. So you asked about the ideological foundations of EA, and I did say that it's a nationalist movement primarily, but a lot of the nationalist community in the Bay Area are also, practically speaking, very, very much social liberals, and with basically a lot of these ideas about how we should have more immigration and how open borders are a net good and so on and so forth. Whereas my argument, which I made using the tools of effective altruism, but which is actually a sort of argument which social liberals might not like very much, is that it is indeed much cheaper to feed, clothe, and accommodate a refugee in, say, some place like Tanzania than it is in Germany, for instance. So you'll need something like $20,000 per year to do that for a refugee in Germany, in some stable African country. You could do it for much for an order of magnitude less money. And another advantage is that take the example of a Syrian doctor or a Syrian engineer who migrates to Germany or the United States or whatever, chances are his qualifications will not suffice to meet the level that is required to practice medicine or engineering in the first world. So in practice, he'll end up doing something like driving a taxi or Uber, I suppose now. And in some sense, this is a misallocation of talent, apart from everything else, a misallocation of human capital. Whereas if he would go to African countries, which are even less developed than Syria, for instance, then he would actually be able to make good use of his qualification because they barely have any doctors or engineers or other highly qualified personnel anyway.
That's an important point because, I mean, take a country like in Africa, there's a fairly small number of high IQ individuals who can become doctors, but those people are so crucial in being there to help people. So if, say, that person immigrates to the United States, some of them do become doctors. You're saying some end up becoming cab drivers, but if they stay in their own country, they can make a really crucial effect in saving people's lives and helping people. The other issue is population in the third world, especially Africa. I know Steve Saylor has been writing this whole series about African population growth patterns and these predictions that right now Africa has about 1 billion people. But based on current trends, it could be as high as 4 billion by the end of the century. Mm-hmm. And that is that's catastrophic growth. But then there's been kind of the issue of birth control. During the Bush era, there has been religious right groups that were blocking birth control in Africa. But there's also been liberals who have blocked it for reasons saying that it's a racist to promote it as well.
This is an issue, yes, the median UN forecasts do indeed say that there will be about 4 billion Africans by the end of the century. I think Africa could handle that because it's a big continent. It's Sub-Saharan Africa has 8 times the landmass of India. This is an interesting statistic. And India has close to 1.5 billion people now. And they're not starving yet. So I don't think this is necessarily going to be catastrophic for Africa, assuming that global warming doesn't progress too rapidly or too catastrophically, and assuming that Africa will continue to hike out reasonable crop yield improvements as it has been doing for the past couple of decades. So I wouldn't say I'm quite as pessimistic as Steve Saylor. And I mean, the fertility transition is happening in Africa. It's just occurring somewhat slower than in the rest of the world, but it's still occurring. There hasn't been a single region in the world which has escaped the demographic transition when they started getting richer.
I want to ask about the possibility of returning to colonialism, since colonialism has a lot to do with a lot of the development we have in Africa right now, because before the Europeans, Africa was a completely undeveloped, uncivilized continent. And well, I'm speaking specifically of sub-Saharan Africa, and so I just want to hear your take on possibility of maybe not like traditional colonialism where countries take over and all that, but more like having like a movement of expatriates from the United States to invest in African countries and live there and maybe possibly shack up with some of the local African women and develop businesses and economies.
Well, that is happening actually with the Chinese primarily.
Right.
Well, I mean, the Chinese are sending their own workers primarily, though, because they can do things much more effectively than African workers because of their data competence and IQ levels. I mean, it's already happening, but how you're going to... I mean, there's already been sort of been an attempt to do this in the form of Liberia back in the previous century, and this repatriation movement of American blacks back to Africa, and it doesn't really seem to have done any good. Liberia is actually, if anything, worse off than the average sub-Saharan African country. So it did have that civil war and General Butt Naked, very interesting character,
huh.
And all sorts of these crazy. So, in a mess, basically.
Anatoly, you sent me a link to this charity and a commentator or blogger from the futurist community. I forget his name, but he's involved with a charity in Africa. Is he affiliated with the Effective Altruist Movement? Forget his name, but you sent me his contact.
Hank Pellis, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you can check out his blog. I mean, last time I heard, he was blogging at brighterbrains.org. And the particular project he is involved in, he's involved in several projects in Africa, primarily in Uganda, if I remember correctly. And one of the ways in which he practices effective altruism is he's a big proponent of anti-worming projects. And he's also doing like some things with, if I remember correctly, I think he's also has some ideas about introducing Soylent into African school children diets it's not natural food, but at least it's got all the minerals and nutrients that that people need in theory anyway. So that might be a relatively cheap way of practicing effective altruism. But yeah, I mean, you can check out his website. He was more interested in psychometrics a few years ago. He wrote some book called 200 Ways to Increase Your IQ, I think that was the title. But he's more involved in charity and doing charity in Africa now.
I was talking to Giovanni Donato. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that blogger, but we were doing a podcast on the post-scarcity economy, and this issue doesn't really get addressed in regards to income inequality between the left and the right. But the main problem with society and increasing income inequality is that there's too much wealth concentrated in the top 1%, and that's something that the left talks about. But the other problem is that there is too much of the population is concentrated in the growing lumpen proletariat. And what we were talking about with Giovanni Donato is basically as the left neglects this issue, but the larger the size of the lumpen proletariat gets, the worse their conditions are. There's less resources to go around as far as schools. There's less jobs available for them. It leads to a more brutal police state and more police brutality in the inner cities. Basically, the larger the size gets. So if you were to reduce the size of the lumpen proletariat, then their quality of life would vastly increase. If you had a much smaller number of poor people, then there could be a lot more social services to take care of them. But then Giovanni's proposals were, we were talking about the basic income, like giving out a basic income in exchange for, say, a woman has more than two kids, like paying the woman a basic income in exchange for getting her tube tied. But do you view that as authoritarian, or do you think that's an example of effective altruism?
Well, I'm not sure it's an example of effective altruism, but I do think it's an example, a pretty clear one, of positive eugenics. So that there's non-coercive eugenics, which I personally am totally okay with.
Yeah, I support positive eugenics if it's done in a humane way. Another interesting point.
It's by definition done in a humane way, because positive eugenics is about incentives, not about coercion. Like, so negative eugenics is when you forcibly sterilize or euthanize, no people with mental defects, like the Nazi Germany did in the 1930s, for instance. And positive eugenics is when you have incentives like paying a well-educated woman more, for instance, to have children or other programs like this, or these getting paying for a woman to have tubes tied if they can't support their children on their own income, those sorts of things.
So, yeah, basically you're saying most people in the effective altruist community are more socially liberal. They would be against that idea, but it's still, you could still say it is, even though most people who describe themselves as effective altruists would oppose that, you could still make the case on a philosophical ground that it's effective.
I don't speak for them. I mean, we really need to carry out an opinion poll. I suspect that a majority of effective altruist people would oppose positive eugenics, but I don't think by very much so, because Scott Alexander, who's a big person, one of the biggest persons in the nationalist community and is close associated with the EA, so he's posted about politically incorrect things from time to time, so it's not like they are leaving SJWs or anything.
Yes, I wanted to ask about how does eugenics tie in with nationalism and national socialism, in that, like, as nationalists, we believe in giving birth to children through the mother, and we want the best possible mothers with the best genes to give birth to children. So what's your take on how all that ties together?
Can you be more specific, please?
Yeah, like, for example, like, let's say What I mean is, like, how the like, why is it important to have a good eugenics program, pretty much for your nation?
Well, I mean, I don't really think you need to be a nationalist per se to be a proponent of positive eugenics. I mean, being a proponent of civilization would be sufficient, because there's a very close correlation between economic performance and average IQ levels, and there's a negative correlation between fertility and IQ. So I mean, idiocracy is totally correct. Basically, there's a lot of studies on this. The duller people are breeding more, are having more children, and they're having them sooner as well. So their percentage of the population is gradually increasing. The average IQ is going down on account of this. So the Flynn effect petered out at most a couple of decades ago. And if it continues that way, I mean, will the just regress to the average IQ levels of Africa, say, in 2 or 3 centuries, if you just let things be, unless fertility patterns change for whatever reason. But they've been pretty consistent so far.
You did write a while back this article called "Not Breeding Their Best." And you post these charts of countries of the highest, basically birth rates in the highest IQ bracket. Did mm-hmm. you really take into account what are some of the unique traits of these countries? What I find fascinating is the countries that actually are on the bottom of the chart, countries like Romania, Italy, Bulgaria, Portugal, those are countries, and then also Hungary and Greece. Those are the countries you would think would be more traditional and religious. And a lot of people on the right wing sort of blame things like feminism and secularism for declining birth rates among like the well-educated. But the countries towards the top of the chart, you have a few Asian countries like Japan, Thailand, Indonesia. But you also basically have all the Scandinavian countries like Iceland, Denmark, Finland, Norway, and even Sweden. Were you just posting the chart, or did you factor in some of the factors that affect these trends?
Okay, look, I posted the data, and I'll describe you what the data is. In the PISA 2000, PISA is a international standardized test administered by the OECD, to OECD countries and partner countries, once every 3 years. And it's a very rich source of psychometric data. It comes out once every 3 years, so you can make comparisons between countries and with some adjustments across time as well. And in 2000, they published the results for math scores, and they also allowed you to filter by the number of siblings that each of those people had, that each of those students had. And what we saw, so by definition, that excludes those children with people in society who don't have any children at all, because they wouldn't be tested in the first place. So actually, even that data is underestimates the true degree of dysgenic decline. But anyway, what you saw quite consistently across countries is that as the number of siblings increased, average performance on the tests decreased as well. So in other words, this is just genetics. The only country there, in fact, which seems to be eugenic is Indonesia, and to a much lesser extent Thailand, although it's slightly dysgenic.
Those two countries, Indonesia and Thailand, what's important to point out is their elite minority is mostly Chinese rather than indigenous.
Well, I think it's more the point that Indonesia and Thailand, I mean, the Chinese are 1% of the population, Indonesia not much more than 2 or 3% in Thailand. The main thing about those countries is that they are still a pretty third world. The Indonesia is at any rate, and they've only undergone the demographic transition a couple of well, pretty recently. So it seems that dysgenic decline only really starts becoming a big factor once you pass the demographic transition and patriarchy breaks down, and the better educated women stop wanting to have kids and so on. So you also pointed out that dysgenic decline is actually counterintuitively less in Sweden or Finland or Norway than it is in Italy, Portugal, Hungary, Greece. And you express some puzzlement over whether that is the case, over why that is the case. I think there's a good explanation for that. So basically, once you have a breakdown of patriarchy and the demographic transition, you do have a transition to dysgenic fertility patterns. But if you also have start well, in those Mediterranean countries, there's this taboo about working mothers, and so women who are orientated on having careers, they just many of them just end up not having children at all. And whereas this is much rarer in Scandinavia, for instance. So I think the main difference is on account of that, actually.
Anatoly, you wrote about artificial wombs on the UNS review. Can you kind of explain the scientific aspect of artificial wombs? So it's the genetics of the father who gives the sperm. Where do they?
Well, no, I mean, the basic idea is just to replace the womb with an artificial equivalent, and this and there was a recent scientific article in which they in which they succeeded to some extent doing that for goats, I think it was. So, I mean, it's a mammal, it's a big mammal. So, if you could replicate that for humans, then potentially this could be a pretty game-changing technology if it is widely adopted. Although I suspect it won't be widely adopted because I would imagine there'd be pretty strong taboos against it.
So would it just be totally artificial, or would it have a genetics of a mother who's a donor? That part I'm not sure about. It's confusing.
Well, yeah, I mean, of course, it's a conventionally fertilized egg, which is simply incubated within an artificial womb instead of like the more conventional way that this happens.
Right. So would you take a fertilized embryo out of a woman's body and put it in an artificial womb?
I don't know the details. I mean, I suppose it will. You'll have to actually do further work on that to find out. But I'm not really very. I don't. It's just something I posted. Oh, look, this article. Look at this article. This seems pretty interesting. It's not something I like to blog about or particularly propagandize or whatever.
Right. I see that the artificial womb could help mitigate some of like the negative social ramifications of feminism by allowing high IQ women to have more children and them not having to take maternity leave so they could be more productive, so that there's a less so they're less reliant on the state or their handouts or anything like that.
Although it probably won't be a complete game changer because, I mean, you'd still need to raise the child, which is actually considerably more effort than carrying them now for 9 months.
Your point in your article is it would only really have an effect on the ultra wealthy who could afford that.
Well, yeah, I suppose that people who can will be able to afford it will use it more. And I mean, I suspect perhaps you could imagine science these sorts of sci-fi scenarios in which some billionaire decides to like the easy brood of 1,000 children or whatever, which would be pretty much impossible the in a conventional way. But it's I mean those sorts of I mean I would imagine it might make for a some interesting science fiction ideas, but I wouldn't really make any statements that go beyond that at the moment.
Right. Yeah, because artificial looms is a big topic within the MGTOW movement. How, like, they think their theory is pretty much if you invent the artificial womb, it would take away some of the bargaining chips from the female, the same way sex robots do. And that will.
Probably, yeah, sure.
So, like, from my perspective, I think. As far as increasing the fertility rate and having more high IQ people in reproducing in the gene pool, I think that's a overall net positive. But continuing on that point, it maybe the artificial womb could make it possible to have, like, say, one woman to have 15 children while she wouldn't be able to do that naturally because it would be too much of a strain on her body.
Oh, well, yeah, sure. I mean,
Another big issue with transhumanism that does get discussed a lot in the transhumanist community is most of these transhumanist technologies will mostly be available to the ultra rich. So it will exacerbate inequality. And basically, in a sense, it can almost kind of split the human race into these two different groups, and one of that has these like super genetics. And Sam, you were telling me earlier that Francis Fukuyama has said that's why he's primarily against transhumanism.
yes, exactly, because he's a liberal, and liberalism at its very basis is a presupposition that all humans are equal and they're sacrosanct. So what transhumanism will do, it will, like, level the playing field of some people in favor at the expense of others, which is why he's against it. Which is kind of ironic because he's the author of The End of History, where he believes that all of human history is progressing towards liberalism.
Anatoly, what are your thoughts on the overall transhumanist movement? Would you say it's in the different factions? Would you say it's primarily tied to the sort of a techno-libertarian crowd, or is it more or neo-reaction, or more to the left, or there's different factions to it?
Well, there's obviously different factions to it, but I definitely think that the centrist nationalist crowd is basically dominant there. I mean, you also have a lot of these more leftist people, though. Although they tend to be less scientifically rigid, so in respect to that, so there's some not very scientific ideas floating around there as well. I mean, overall, I'm mostly interested in transhumanism in the sense that I'm interested in the history of technology and by extension the future of technology, and in the sense that the practical vistas that it opens up potentially could be very influential to the history of the 21st century, and very practically useful and to be welcomed. So, I mean, I don't know about you, but I very much welcome like genetically engineering humans, say, to be 5 standard deviations more intelligent than baseline, or implementing radical life extension if it becomes possible. So all of these things, and or widespread automation, all of these things I'm very much in favor of. And I mean, if they're technically possible, somebody is going to do them anyway. So there's no good reason not to actually do them if it's possible.
Is this a speculation for the distant future, or are there scientists actively working for solutions as we speak about things like radical life extension, and there's also the CRISPR gene editing?
So intelligence augmentation is already possible through embryo selection. I mean, we already know about 100 genes that determine that influence IQ to some extent. So this is actually already implementable. Direct gene editing through CRISPR might become realistic in another 10 or so years, going by the more optimistic estimates. I mean, very intelligent people have already existed, so it's not as if you're engineering something radically new or anything. This is the reason why radical life extension will probably be substantially harder, simply because whereas the most intelligent person ever might have had an IQ of say 200, the longest lived person ever was that French woman. I think she lived to 126. And to be fair, 126 isn't really that much of a cardinal difference relative to 80, which is the life expectancy in most first world countries, plus or minus 2 years. You're basically going much above 120, you're going to have to find either entirely new genetic variants which would enable that, or you'd have to do some serious engineering on your body to make that happen, I would imagine. So that's a harder problem.
Yeah, I have a question. Would the nuclear family be replaced with the techno-commercial state with transhumanism, artificial wombs, state education, orphanages, and so on?
Well, I have no idea. I mean, if and what is that contingent on? If there's automation and radical life extension and average IQs of 175? I find it difficult. It's very difficult to project current society because, a society where the average IQ is 175, say, would be so radically different to what we have today. It's just basically impossible to envisage, I would argue.
Yeah, the reason why I'm saying that is because in the modern day, the nuclear family has, for the most part, been replaced when it comes to raising children with popular cultures, state education, mm-hmm. and so on. Like, it's pretty much come to a point where the only service of the nuclear family in the modern day is providing the kids a place to live.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I would actually caution against extending modern trends towards a hypothetical society with an average IQ of 175, because if you're familiar with Charles Murray's Coming Apart, he actually notices that the breakdown of the nuclear family has actually progressed most in the lumpen proletariat areas of the United States, the fish towns. Whereas nuclear family is paradoxically actually quite strong in those liberal 110 average IQ sort of more upper middle class places. And they have more of them send their children to private schools. I wouldn't say that you'll automatically get this trend towards greater role of state and state schooling and state orphanages or whatever if people were to become more intelligent. I mean, I wouldn't even say you could make a good prediction on that because, I mean, social trends in the United States seem to have actually gone the other way.
Right.
One other thing that's interesting on this kind of future prediction angle is the kind of society that we're heading towards that's more conformist and controlled is dependent on large numbers of stupid people who can be easily manipulated. But if you had this society of like these super geniuses of 170 IQs, you would have kind of the opposite issue where you'd have all these people constantly challenging each other either for power or for intellectual ideas. So that could bring about conflict, but it would be different than this kind of the trend we're heading in right now of just mass control of the conformist masses.
Well, I suppose so. One interesting idea is that what if we assume that there is no consumerism, which is what I did in my article, The Unstable View, A Short History of the Third Millennium. Do you want to talk about this?
So just to kind of give a basic introduction to this, does this have to do with the book you're working on about the Neo-Malthusianism?
Sort of, yes. So let me explain it. So there's this prospect that we could develop machine superintelligence, and then who knows what will happen. Maybe they'll kill us all. Maybe we'll merge our consciences with the machine god or whatever, like in Deus Ex. Or perhaps we'll go down this route of genetically augmenting IQs to some super high level, in which case it will also be very difficult to predict anything because, I'm not anywhere near 175 IQ. I don't really know how those people think. How it is even possible to project how a society of them would behave is basically completely beyond our capabilities. So what if we actually simplify the problem and just assume that there's no technological singularity, there's no intelligence augmentation, there's no new revolutionary technologies? What will happen if it's business as usual, as the economists say? Well, in that case, a good start perhaps might be to project some of the current trends we have, especially in demographics, into the future, and see what kind of society is likely to develop out of this. So one thing that we see is that, first of all, the less intelligent people are having more kids and they're having them sooner. So the average IQ is going down because intelligence is highly heritable. And another very important thing, however, is that fertility is closely correlated with fertility preferences. So a simple way of saying that is that people who want to have more children, they generally have more children. So that makes sense, right?
And, so your point is that it's a misconception that there's all these people who want to have more children, but they're being kept back by their economic situation.
Well, not really. I mean, there's a lot of contributory factors towards this. I mean, back in a few centuries ago, the average woman had 7 children because simply that was the cultural norm back then. I wouldn't say that. I'm just assuming that society and culture remains fixed and doesn't change, so as to get that out of the way. And it shouldn't, because if average IQ declines, as I'm positing, then technological progress should also come to a halt, because the percentage of smart fractions capable of progressing technology are going to diminish. Returning to my point about fertility preferences. Fertility preferences are a characteristic of personality, and all personality characteristics, without exception, are to some extent heritable. And there's some evidence that, some concrete evidence that fertility preferences are heritable. So, in effect, what you're going to see is a reversal of the demographic transition. So, once you had this demographic transition, so many more women in the workforce and urbanization, and liberalization and so forth. You had the collapse in fertility from the 5 to 7 children that you had in the pre-industrial world to the 1.5 or 2 or 2.5 children that is more typical of the industrial world. And but because higher fertility preferences are heritable, and by almost by definition, people with higher fertility preferences have more children, you're going to get a reversal of the demographic transition, and people will start having more and more children. And assuming that technology remains static, we assume that because IQ is going to decline, you'll eventually have a rapidly expanding population again, up until the point that the global population bumps up against the carrying capacity of the industrial economy, which is, well, I mean, you can't really say what that figure is going to be. I suspect it's going to be somewhere around 50 or 100 billion people. Other people think
it's... Well, you really think it's that high? I've read the mainstream predictions. Right now it's 6 to 7 billion. I think the prediction is that the global population will cap at about 10 to 12 billion.
Again, that's assuming that there's going to be a demographic transition, and that this demographic transition is going to be permanent. But as I pointed out, it's once you have a post-scarcity environment where Malthus doesn't punish people for having more kids than they can support, because, I mean, ultimately the social state takes care of them. I mean, nobody starves to death or dies of malnutrition in first world countries or even second world countries today. This means there's no population control and there's no checking of fertility preferences. And the future generations are going to be have higher and higher fertility preferences on account of this. And so population increase will resume as a consequence.
What is your project on the neo-Malthusianism about? Is that a book you're working on? And this article is sort of the introduction to that?
Sort of. I mean, I this article came into my head, and I decided that you can actually expand it into a short futurist book along the lines of, say, Hansen's The Age of M. So I was influenced quite a lot by that. So just take some assumptions and see where that leads you to. And I think it's important to do that, to do this exercise, because there's been a lot of books published about all sorts of scenarios, like the technological singularity and a Malthusian collapse, various post-apocalyptic scenarios. But not a lot of people, like virtually nobody, has seriously asked themselves what will happen if things remain just the way things are. What if it's just business as usual? Now take those trends and project them into the future and see what you get. Surprisingly, not a lot of people have done that, even though one would think it would be a pretty important thing to cover.
Can you explain to our audience what the concept of the techno-singularity is?
It's basically the technological singularity. I didn't feel like writing out technological singularity every time. Thought I'd save myself on a few letters. But classically, a technological singularity is when you invent a machine, an intelligent machine, that can augment its own intelligence. So it doesn't really need require human input to augment its own intelligence. And the theory is that at some point, if you create an intelligent enough machine, it might start to improve itself or create other more intelligent machines, and that this will acquire a takeaway process. Like when something just goes out of control. And I mean, I don't see any reason why that shouldn't happen. But that's the classical way in which it was formulated. The guy who first came up with the idea was probably a guy called Good back in the 1960s. There was also a famous article on that by the sci-fi writer Werner Winge in the 1980s, The Age of Intelligent Machines, I think it was called, or something like that.
With artificial intelligence, what are your thoughts of the feasibility of people augmenting their memory into artificial intelligence as a way to basically preserve their memory, and I guess in a sense to the kind of attempt to achieve immortality?
I suppose that it could happen theoretically. I don't know if it will happen. Preferably, the way I think is would prefer is that the technological singularity can be harnessed, and that humans could sort of try to integrate themselves with the new machine civilization or become one with it. That seems to be preferable to a scenario in which the machines just decide that bothering with the humans is ineffective and just kill them all, or I don't know, lock them away in a reservation. I suppose we'll live and see.
So we are getting close to the end of the show, but to kind of wrap things up, Anatoly, would you say the most, you're primarily interested in the more practical aspects of transhumanism rather than this kind of a far-off speculation. Would you say the most practical aspects of it that are more feasible are the two main ones are the radical life extension or even moderate life extension and the CRISPR gene editing? Those two things would you say are the most important? Would you say it's
No, I think the most important and the most perspective, actually, as in things that I'm pretty sure that will actually technologically develop within the next generation, is CRISPR genetic editing plus in combination with the genomics of IQ and automation. I think those are the big two for the next generation. Radical life extension, as I said, I'm considerably more skeptical of it, although it was seen as pseudoscience a decade ago, and it's now seen as much more realistic nowadays. So Google has even created Calico, which is a special company that's specifically dedicated to this problem. But I think that's going to be further off.
And with the gene editing, is that actually changing the genes or just analyzing the embryos to see which embryo has a certain defects?
You can do the latter already, actually. So this is already something that's possible and people are doing for various genetically heritable diseases. And the next logical extension to that would be testing embryos for intelligence. There might be some taboos against that in Judeo-Christian countries like the United States, but the Chinese don't really have those taboos, so they might be more enthusiastic about that. So yes, that's something that's already happening. The CRISPR genetic editing in combination with knowing the genomics of IQ is something that I optimistically is expect to be realized but within a decade. So that's also the opinion of Charles Murray and the Zeev Hahn and a few other people.
What are your thoughts on the fusing of technology and humans? There's things like the artificial hearts, or the more kind of a science fiction thing is giving people. I mean, this is already happening now, but it's in the early stages of production, giving people artificial hands and artificial body parts, or implementing cybernetics, which is putting computer chips into people's brains.
Oh yes, Musk's idea. Well, yeah, I totally support all of this. Even from a humanitarian perspective, it's better to have a prosthetic hand than no hand. There's a video game series called Deus Ex in which people go a bit overboard with that, so people start hacking off their limbs to replace them with these military limbs to be more effective soldiers or miners or whatever. But realistically speaking, that's not going to happen in our world. I don't think, because I mean, biological hands are just much, much better than prosthetic hands, at least for now. And as for Musk's idea of neural lace, I'm actually very skeptical about this mostly because of the translation problem. Nick Bostrom, in his book Superintelligence, describes it, like provides a whole set of different arguments why it's overdone, and I think Musk is actually like it's another one of his far off ideas which won't really come to anything, like the Hyperloop and that tunnel boring machine. But the main thing is the translation problem. It's unclear. It's unclear how you can translate a thought in the brain to an electronic circuit. So they just don't map to each other. I mean, if you were to solve that, you'd do it. The ramifications of that would be far larger than just neural lace. But it's an extremely hard problem. I don't think it's going to be solved anytime soon.
So you're basically referring to the cybernetics?
Yes, the neural lace, which you mentioned. I'm skeptical that anything will come out of that anytime soon.
And we're at the end of the show, but Anatoly, when is your book going to come out? Are you still working on it?
Yeah, I'm still working on it. I never give out the deadlines because I never fulfill them anyway.
Anatoly Karlin, it's been an excellent show. Thanks mm-hmm. for being on.
All right, thank you, Robert Stack, for inviting me on. It's always a pleasure.
And also, thanks, Sam Kevorkian.
You're welcome.